Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
And good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're also pleased to have here on the show once again, Mae Barenbaum. She's a professor of entomology at the U of I and occasionally here on the program. Generally, during the warmer months when insects are active, she's here on the program. And we encourage people to call in and ask questions about insects. As I always try to remind people, the focus of these programs that when Mae is here is to try to appreciate insects for the many and varied ways they go about living their lives. When she is here, we say, hold your extermination questions. We have a guy for that, Phil Nixon, and I'm sure probably not too long we'll probably have Phil on the program because sometimes insects can be a problem. If you get them in your house, you have them in your garden, you may want to take steps to get rid of them. But that's a separate thing entirely. When Mae is here, we do the other. We just engage our curiosity and try to enjoy and appreciate insects. And at about this time of year, now also for a long time, we've had Mae here on the program, so she could talk about the Insect Fear Film Festival. Now, how many years? 18
years?
This
is our 23rd year.
23 years it has been going on here. And truly has gotten attention around the world. You know how journalists are, they get bored. And, you know, when something wacky comes along like the Insect Fear Film Festival, well, it's going to get attention. So internationally famed.
A lot of slow news days over the last 23 years.
So this time around, the festival focuses on the mantis, and it's going to happen a week from tomorrow.
That's right. So we try now, you know, when we started, we just basically featured different sort of genres of insect fear films. But now we build them around an insect-related theme or arthropod-related theme. And there finally are enough mantis-themed films that we can build a program around them. And this is a lot of fun because one of our goals is to dispel misinformation about insects. And there's probably no other group of insects about which there is more misinformation. An information widely embraced by the public at large. So
then with the mantis, really?
Yeah. Well, everyone. I mean, if you ask anyone on the street, what do you know about insects? One of the three or four facts that they'll be absolutely dead certain of is that male mantids or female mantids will eat their mates.
Yes.
And it turns out that in all likelihood, that's a laboratory artifact for the vast majority of species. So it's indeed true that mantids in captivity female mantids will eat their mate while they're in the act. But this is a highly unnatural situation. I mean, there's even humans being observed in their most intimate moments are probably likely to do things that aren't, you know, really representative of the species. So, you know, mantids are predators. They orient visually to their prey. And without the right environmental cues, it's easy to mistake a male for a meal, you know?
How true that is. In the in nature, in the wild, so to speak, when people have been observing these insects, they have not seen this behavior?
The vast majority of reports are from laboratory observations. In fact, probably what propelled this concept into sort of the scientific communal mind was a paper that was published in the late 19th century by a very distinguished entomologist, L.O. Howard, who observed an act of sexual cannibalism and published it in a high-profile journal called Science, sort of the journal all scientists read. And in retrospect, it's amazing that that paper got published because it's based on and sample size of one. I don't think you could get this published today, you know? But it was so spectacular and so lurid and so kind of grotesque that people, of course, immediately embraced it.
So he saw this happen one time.
And wrote it up for
and
science.
Wrote it up, and somehow then that became to represent this entire group of insects, just based on one observation that he made.
Well, there was another follow-up sort of about 50 years later, another very famous scientific paper by a guy named Ken Roeder, who was a neurophysiologist who observed that decapitating a male mantis will actually remove inhibitory stimuli. I don't know. We're not on after. I don't know if there are little kitties. Kids listening here.
This show is just getting more and more right over the edge.
But certain inhibitions were released, and that could account for these laboratory observations and occasional field observations of decapitated males actually performing. But even if you go back to that original paper, even Roeder doesn't think this is an absolutely necessary part of the courtship process. And it's interesting in retrospect to see how people sort of, after the fact, justified it. Well, of course it makes sense because mantids don't occur in very high densities, and this way the male is provisioning the female with many resources so she can make a lot of oothiki, these egg cases, the sort of styrofoam packing crates they put their eggs in. Not really sort of mantis styrofoam. But in reality, under natural conditions, this has not been observed very frequently, and there are certainly species of mantids for which it has never been observed. And there's over 2,000 species of mantids. So, So this is like the most beloved and, you know, the one fact people know and they're proud of.
It may, in fact, not be a fact. Yeah. Well, we'll put that on the list of all those things that people know that ain't so.
Yeah. And can I just add one more that my 15-year-old daughter says that she's having a hard time convincing her friends of?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not exactly an insect fact. It's an arthropod fact. I guess the general wisdom is that people eat on average 3 spiders a day during their sleep, and that over your lifetime you will have consumed some inordinately large number of spiders. There, as far as I know, no literature document that inadvertent, I guess it would be aranophagy, eating spiders, is at all the rule. I don't know of any documentation for that particular bit of wisdom.
So. This is the first time I'm hearing this. So somehow people have this idea that people are lying there in bed and they're snoring or something, and spiders are just walking along and happen to fall into the chasm of their mouth.
Yeah.
And, how very strange.
Yeah, leaving little telltale spider tracks in the whitening strips or something. I don't know how it arose, but there's this pervasive notion out there among 15-year-olds that every day you're eating spiders in your sleep, and I think people can rest assured that that's not the case.
Well, here we are again, once again, Focus 580, boldly challenging the misconceptions and trying to fill in the reality there. And this is just one of many shows in which we do that. If you have questions, if you have insect questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, this now prompts further questions about insect reproduction. I guess one of the things that I thought was true, and, you know, you can tell me if it's not true, is that for many insects, virtually the only function they have in their adult form is to reproduce. Is that
basically
generally true?
That's the secret to the most successful insects' great success. The so-called holometabola. These are the advanced insects, the ones where the immature stages don't look like the adults. Baby butterflies are caterpillars, and baby flies are maggots. And this is a well-known principle of manufacturing economics, is you sort of diversify function. You partition out different functions for different use your resources most effectively at different life stages. So the immature stage is dedicated to growth and acquiring resources. And immature insects are called larvae of this particular group of insects are phenomenally good at growing bigger. I mean, inconceivably good. I mean, a caterpillar from egg hatch to pupation can increase size from 4,000-fold to 10,000-fold in 2 weeks. And you imagine a newborn baby, a 7-pound baby, increasing its weight 1,000-fold in 2 weeks. You know, this would create major problems. I mean, just keeping the kid in diapers, you know. Just staggering how efficiently they can grow and increase in size. But then it's because they're not doing anything else. So the next stage, the life stage, the adult stage, is specialized for reproduction. And it's very useful then to have wings at that stage, because then you can go find mates. And in fact, in many species, once the adult has mated, the female adult has mated, the muscles that power the wings will often dissolve and get rebuilt into eggs. So the entire eggs are normally produced in the abdomen, but the capacity for carrying and producing eggs extends into where the thoracic muscles are. So they're highly specialized, and that's really been a very efficient system for them.
Hmm. So then I guess the thing that I was wondering about was, and I'm not exactly sure what the terminology is here, but say any pair, your average pair of insects, male and female, how many broods they would have? Is that mostly just happen once, or are there some where they have multiple?
Well, as you might guess, with a million species, there are all kinds of answers. And the one extreme, for example, is the species of the tsetse fly, Glossina species. This is a little fly that's kind of related to our house fly. And they are the exception among insects in that the females produce one offspring at a time. And in fact, they produce a milk-like substance, and it's almost like the mammalian system, where this one maggot lives inside the mother's body and gets all its nutrition from the mother until just before it's ready to pupate, whereupon it emerges from the mother's body, pupates, and then goes off once it emerges to go feed on blood of cattle and, depending on the species, sometimes humans. Mm. And that's extraordinarily atypical for insects. Far more typical is the ability to produce large numbers of offspring at any one time. That's a brood, and many broods. Like, for example, German cockroaches, which is the sort of cockroach of choice, I guess, in campus town. The female cockroach will produce these egg cases. Cockroaches, by the way, are mantids' closest living relatives. They don't like to admit it, but it's true. And because they produce the same sort of little egg case, although it looks more like a valise in the case of cockroaches than a styrofoam packing crate. So for the German cockroach, each little ootheca or egg case has maybe 3 to 4 dozen eggs. And over the course of its lifetime, a German cockroach can produce, you know, half a dozen or more of those little egg cases. But then there are some species at the other extreme that will produce hundreds of offspring only once. And the best example of that, there's some species of mites where the female, after she mates, just basically produces huge numbers of eggs, and then the hatching mites burst through her body. And that's kind of the last thing she ever does. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess motherhood can be thankless at times, but never as thankless as it is for those mites. So, and that's sometimes called... Well, I guess they call it Big Bang reproduction, just because it's this one explosive event of reproduction. So, and everything in between. The one thing insects are good at is reproducing, and there's just about every variant you can imagine, including some. I don't know if our listeners are ready for some of the things that insects can do. So.
Right. Well, we have a couple of callers here, and we have, as our guest, May Barenbaum. She's professor and head of the Department of Entomology at University of Illinois. Every once in a while she's here. We talk about insects, and we will talk some, I promise we'll talk some more about the festival, too, coming up 1 week from tomorrow on the U of I campus. We have a couple of folks here who would like to talk with us, and we'll start with Champagne, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
I have a couple of insects I'm wondering about. Actually, there's three of them that I guess we'll focus on too, since you probably have a lot of callers. But in the 70s, after reading Carlos Castaneda's The Teachings of Don Juan, and the cricket, you know, was always present, and I remember at night I would always hear crickets. Where are they? I don't hear them anymore. And well, so that was one question that I had. Yeah, and then my other question is because I was thinking also about the bees. and their importance in the survival of man. And so I'd like it if you could just tap on those two topics, and I would really appreciate it. And thanks so much.
All right.
Sure.
Thank you.
Well, you ask a question that a lot of people ask about a lot of insects, that when we were younger, there were a lot more luna moths around. When you were younger, there were a lot more cicadas around, although cicadas come and go. And in terms of crickets, too, in general, what's thought to be involved in this apparent decline in the abundance of certain types of insects is the fact that there's been a lot of habitat destruction as people have sort of built up around city edges and suburbanized what were wild or natural areas. We're basically taking away the places that certain types of insects do best in. And it's very hard to quantify because, you know, not many people are out there. The only ones who are actually measuring population sizes are entomologists, and there are not a lot of those around. And so sometimes it's hard to come up with an explanation or even evidence that there are declines. In one particular case, the giant Saturnian silk moths like the Cecropias and the Promethea moths and the Luna moths, big, spectacular, showy moths, there have been good records because these are insects people do pay attention to, kind of like. And they are in decline. And at least in the northeastern U.S., it appears that some of our efforts at biological control may have gone awry. There was a parasitic fly was introduced to control gypsy moths in the Northeast at the turn of the 20th century. And this is a parasite that lays its eggs inside the bodies of other insects. This one has about 300 different hosts, including a lot of totally innocuous moths like the Lunas and the Cecropias. And it may be that the decline in the abundance of these giant silk moths was sort of an inadvertent effect of biological control. And that's not to single out biological control. Certainly in the 60s, the heavy use of synthetic organic insecticides had a lot of non-target impacts as well. And that kind of leads into your next question about the bees. And there's been a lot of concern about whether or not bee populations are in decline. There's one species that upon which we here in, Western nations in general depend exceedingly heavily upon. About a third of our diet is the result of pollination activities of Apis mellifera, the Western honeybee, which, by the way, isn't native to North America. It comes from Europe. And so honeybees are responsible for pollinating an astounding number of crop plants, everything ranging from apples and cherries and blueberries and melons and squashes and watermelons and zucchini and cabbage and onions. And, you know, the way I have longtime listeners know, the way I illustrate the impact of honeybee pollination is without honeybees, a Big Mac would have no all-beef patty because honeybees pollinate clover and alfalfa, which is used to feed cattle. All-beef patty. No lettuce, no cheese, no pickles, no onions, and no sesame seeds. You'd have the bun, and I don't know what's in special sauce, so I can't
no
tell
you.
No
one knows.
Yeah. But so without honeybees, our honeybees have an estimated – hi there. There's another visitor here. It's been estimated $15 billion contribution to our economy. There's Jack. Hi.
Yeah. Yes, Jack Brighton has stepped into the studio. Now, so if you're not done, you could continue. But we are sort
Please.
Of we need to also
sure,
do a little
sure. No, I,
a little
yeah,
pledging here.
I thought maybe I'd said something untoward or that he was questioning
was
my numbers on honeybees.
I was hoping you would say something untoward, but so far, you know.
Focus 580 is generally not the show that says something untoward. That's not usually one of our mottos, but maybe it could be.
We could work on that.
Yeah. Well, let us talk with someone in Indiana here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm a subscriber to WILL and Wings, so it's sort of an interesting day. Off the record, I was interested in, there's two questions, but this is just something more sociological. You're a member of the board directors of Wings. I was wondering, do you meet face-to-face, or is it email, teleconference, or something like that when you get things done? And the two questions. One, I wonder if you could say something about vision and wing markings. What kind of test would an entomologist do to do whatever he wanted to prove one way or the other? And secondly, this is more at home. A couple of days ago, I opened up a long box I had for packing purposes, and I pulled out a it's a styrofoam. It's like a sponge. It's circular. What it's used is to protect pipettes inside the packing case. And on it was a huge mound of a gray clay, and I thought, this must be some kind of wasp. And since I needed this little foam piece, I gently took it off the edge. Well, lo and behold, there were two wasps in some sort of a translucent cocoon next to that surface. And I thought, well, I took it back out in the garage and I put it on some kind of a cardboard thing, and, you know, so it'd be, go through the regular winter temperature. I was wondering if you could say something about that. I found another one in my garage. It's a similar shape, but it had a hole in it, and it was the same gray color, so I figured it's, you know, same wasp, or maybe, you know, the wasp are doing their thing. And I didn't know too much about that. Most of the ones I've come across have been little ones in a corner, or the more like paper-like things you might find, you know, in trees and things and places like that. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Well, that's the first question. The caller's referring to an organization called the Xerxes Society for the Preservation of Endangered Invertebrates. So this is an organization that is worried about extinction of multi-legged creatures that are not as charismatic as the Florida panther or the bald eagle. So it really is kind of an uphill struggle to raise awareness about the fact that insects do, in fact, can, in fact, and have, in fact, gone extinct. Something as a class, never. I mean, they rule the planet. But individual species that can be so specialized and so particular about their habitat and their resource requirements that, you know, human activities have led to the disappearance of, documented disappearance of insect species. So I write for the magazine that the Xerxes Society puts out called Wings. And it's you can't imagine what a hard sell it is to sometimes the least charismatic endangered species. For example, the parasites, the ticks that, for example, that attack endangered vertebrates. Like the tick that is specialized on the white rhino is endangered because white rhinos are endangered. But really hard to come up with a campaign to save the white rhino tick. Probably the least charismatic is the pygmy hog sucking louse, which is also endangered. It feeds only on pygmy hogs, but, you know, you don't get a lot of... So it's a struggle, and we don't meet... I've met the directors. We've been at some meetings together, the directors of the executive director of the Xerxes Society, but otherwise all the business is conducted by email. And I think it's really a wonderful organization. And Wings is a beautiful magazine. If you're at all interested in gorgeous insect photography and informative insect writing, then it's by subscribing to the magazine, you're also supporting the organization. There was a question about the gray wasp. What was the second thing?
It had to do with what he said was vision and wing markings.
Oh, right, right.
And
yes.
I guess I'm. I hope you know what that means.
Well, their wing markings serve a multiplicity of purposes, and sometimes the purpose is to look like something inedible, so that your predators will. Mistake you for something else. Sometimes there are patterns that are called flash patterns or protean coloration, surprise, P-R-O-T-E-A-N, not protein, like flash patterns, things that are surprises, wing spots, a whole lot of insects, moths in particular, that, you know, have four wings that are patterned like lichen or bark. If you disturb them, will expose their hind wings, and you'll see big eyes, a pair of eyes looking at you, which is very disconcerting for a predator. In fact, apropos of our festival, many mantises have these very spectacular display patterns with eye spots. Then there are also disruptive patterns where there'll be a black butterfly with a white stripe, and that will make it difficult for a predator to follow the movement of the insect against a background of trees. And how people have figured out what the function of this color, these color patterns are, various ways, particularly altering them, blackening in a white stripe and seeing if a species is more likely to get eaten, was some of the most, the classic work on protective colorations done right here at the University of Illinois by my colleague, now Emeritus Professor Gil Waldbauer, who took Promethea moths, which are normally black, and painted them to look like monarch butterflies, and also painted them to look like a tiger swallowtail. Monarch butterflies are protected because they are distasteful. They sequester or store heart poisons from their food plant. Tiger swallowtails are don't eat poisonous plants. They eat like cherry leaves and ash leaves and the like. And as far as anyone knows, they're completely delicious. And the way he could recapture these, he raised them up, painted them to look like either Promethea moths or monarch butterflies or tiger swallowtails. And the way you recapture them, the males will orient to virgin females. They'll fly up to 7 miles to find a virgin female. So he released the painted males and then had traps with baited with female moths. And then he counted the number that came back and looked at the condition of the ones that came back. And the ones painted like monarchs came back and rarely had beak marks on them. The ones painted like tiger swallowtails, for the most part, he never saw them again, although a few came back looking very bedraggled and with big chunks out of their wings. So this was really compelling evidence that this is protective, this coloration is protective. And again, apropos of our festival, a lot of mantids not only have surprise patterns, but many are so-called cryptically colored. They look like bark or twigs or flowers spectacularly. There's one called the orchid mantis that looks just like an orchid. And this is because they're ambush predators. They sit and wait. They remain stock still. And if you don't blend in with your background, then not only are you likely to not surprise your prey, but you're also likely to become prey yourself if you contrast with your background. So there are some really terrific, some just impressive-looking mantids. And then there's a whole other set of answers if you're interested in how these wing spots develop, how patterns change. Because there are species, for example, it's called the mocker swallowtail in Africa, where the male looks like a typical yellow swallowtail, and the females in different parts of Africa look like 7 other different species of insects. So wherever they occur, they look like the most toxic species there. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a common name for these that where the female has many different body coloration patterns. They're called Mormon butterflies because one guy has many wives. So that's the common name. As for the gray nest, That's a little hard to say. There are some wasps that are called potter wasps that make sort of clay-like, grayish clay-like vase-shaped nests, and that is a possibility. It could have been one of those mud, like a mud dauber species that you could find near the ground that would not have a paper-like nest. That would be my best guess, because when you say gray, it does, and clay-like, there's a whole group, the species called Eumenes, the genus is Eumenes, they have these sort of like clay pot kind of nests. It is pretty unusual, though, to find them in that kind of packing material.
Okay. Now, what I want to know is, how do you get a butterfly to stand still long enough to paint it? How exactly does one paint a butterfly?
You would be surprised. What goes on in our department here, people are painting bees. They're painting even much smaller insects than butterflies. Butterflies are actually pretty easy to paint. And the thing is, too, if you're working with a species that's normally toxic, if an insect lets you catch it, don't eat it because it's most likely poisonous. The insects that are really hard to catch are the ones that are probably the most palatable. In terms of these giant silk moths, like the Promethea moth, they're not really very fast moving. They're they're pretty sleepy during the day. So if you get them during the day, it's pretty easy to just pick them up and paint them. But yeah, you know, it's my nephew, in fact, spent a summer here. You know, kids, high school kids to make money will paint houses. He painted bees for his summer activity.
Oh, that's a story. All right. Well, let's talk with somebody else. Yeah. Let's go to line one in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I had to go to Florida a couple months ago, and before we went, there was a lot of talk about bed bugs, which made wife and I very nervous. And but it looks like we survived, though I understand that they can live a year without eating. So I was just wondering if you could talk about bed bugs a bit and maybe give us some idea of, is there any way to find out if they're infesting a place or not? I understand that the odds are that the answer to that is no, but I thought I'd ask anyway, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Right. This was something that I wanted to ask you about, because recently in the newspapers, I've been reading all these stories and in a lot of different places complaining about a resurgence of bed bugs. Australia, the United States, Canada, Europe, bed bugs seem to be making a comeback, so to speak. And so what's going on?
Well, you know, bed bugs are human parasites. They're true bugs. That means they have piercing mouth parts, and they are not what are called permanent ectoparasites. They don't live on your body like lice. They actually live in cracks of walls and lice and come out at night and will feed on a host. And they were exceedingly rare. Back in the 40s, 30s and 40s, they were associated with transient hotels and flop houses and places of ill repute where they would live in mattresses and cracks in walls and torment people who slept there. And then with the advent of synthetic organic insecticides, to which they were very susceptible, they essentially disappeared. And as an entomology graduate student and as a professor, I had never seen a live bed bug until about 10 years ago. I got one in the mail. And it was one of these things where it came with a letter and it said, can you tell me what this is? I can't sleep at night. I'm being eaten alive. And I opened the container and it crawled out. And usually they send them dead. And this one was, it looked just like the pictures. So this was sort of the beginning of the upsurge. And what has undoubtedly contributed to the resurgence of bed bugs is globalization of trade and travel. So what they do, infest mattresses and other sleeping areas and are easily transportable. And as the caller said, like most ectoparasites that don't live on their host, they can withstand long periods of time without between meals. And that allows them with supersonic or high-speed transport to survive a trip across the Atlantic. Even with, you know, 4 hours on the tarmac, like all the delays, they can get to your destination. And they seem to be resistant to the generation of pesticides that replaced the synthetic organic insecticides that had major environmental impacts, such as DDT and the like. And they present a major control problem. In New York now, they're discussing a ban on the resale of mattresses.
Yeah, I read about that.
Because that seems to be one way they do get around. And that one that came in the mail was from, it turned out she had bought a used mattress. And sometimes you can spot there are little characteristic spots on the walls. It's where they defecate, actually. But you have to be really observant to know that. And usually the best way to know if a place is infested is if you wake up and there's bites all over your body.
So you can't, if you're planning to go someplace, it sounds like it's not going to be possible for you to know in advance, is that country, is that town, is that hotel, wherever you're going, is that likely to be a problem?
Well, let's just suffice it to say it's likely to be a problem.
Yeah. And
they're really a major source of concern. There was a lawsuit in Chicago, in fact, and New York. And they're not flop houses. These are four-star hotels that are getting affected. There's also supposedly in a major infestation a characteristic bed buggy smell. But if you've never smelled it before, it's going to be hard. They do, like many of the true bugs, they do produce offensive odors. Particularly when they're disturbed. But again, it's not something that if you've never smelled it before, that you'd recognize if you smelled. And there was an entire symposium devoted to bed bugs at the Entomological Society of America meeting in Fort Lauderdale in December. I hadn't heard that anyone actually had them in the room, so maybe the bed bugs knew this was not a good hotel to infest. So,
and just maybe one more question: then, supposing that you go someplace and you encounter them, is there anything that you can do to try to prevent then bringing them back from that place to your house?
Well, that's a good question, because they're very flat. They are extraordinarily flat. And that lets them get into cracks and crevices, and they're expandable, so they can suck a lot of blood at once. But they're very pale colored; they're sort of a brownish color, so they can. It's easy to overlook them, and that's probably contributed to their enormous resurgence here. They're related to species that live in bird nests, but we happen to be their preferred hosts, I guess. And as you might guess, they don't have many natural enemies. There is another species of true bug called the masked bedbug hunter, which is an assassin bug, which is a predaceous bug. But you know, they don't travel as well in suitcases as the bedbugs do.
All right. Well, let's see if we get at least one more call here. Someone in Iroquois County. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I had an interesting experience, and Phil Novak helped me this summer. I woke up and I found something on my night clothes, and I had my glasses off, so I kind of picked it, and it broke, and it was had blood in it. Well, I took that little, which I thought we had been traveling. I thought that's a bed bug. I took it to Phil, and he said it's closely related, but it's a bat, B-A-T mm-hmm. bug, and you probably had bats in your attic, and they probably vacated, and they probably came down being hungry and bit me. So we sprayed, and I haven't seen any since then. But it was kind of a problem at the moment, because I thought, oh, no, not bed bugs.
That's pretty unusual. The bat bug is a little bit smaller than the bed bug. It's about 15/100ths of an inch long instead of about 20/100ths of an inch long. But there's also swallow bugs. There's poultry bugs. This is a whole family, the cymicids. These are blood-feeding ectoparasites, and they're very good at all of them are good at cracks and crevices.
Well, I did spray all in around the cracks and crevices in the ceiling in our bedroom and so on, and later I found, and we did have a white carpet there so I could find them fairly easily, there were several of these little things lying dead on the carpet from above the window areas and so on. So every so often I do spray again just to keep them away from me. Just thought you might find it interesting.
Well, you know, it's since time immemorial, the word bug actually derives from these guys. And it is related to a word that means sort of hobgoblin or night visitor. So humans have been dealing with these for a very long time. I don't think there's an easy solution in sight.
Are these guys related to other similar sounding things like fleas, ticks?
Nope. No, these are, they're more closely related to stink bugs, milkweed bugs. Many of their relatives are plant feeders. Some of them are predaceous, but ticks aren't even insects. So we humans provide a tasty meal to all kinds of blood-feeding parasites.
So ticks, are they more related to spiders?
Spiders, yeah. Oh, okay. To their credit, bed bugs are not associated with the transmission of any significant diseases, unlike many of the blood feeders, which can, you know, spread mass death and destruction in their wake, including, you know, mosquitoes in particular.
Yeah.
Fleas
mm-hmm.
are major vectors. Ticks are important vectors. But bed bugs are just incredibly annoying.
Just a nuisance. You wouldn't want it.
They bug you,
at least,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Hence the etymology here.
We're getting close to the end of the time, and, you know, I want to make sure that we do talk a little bit about the – I give you a chance to talk a little bit about the festival. As we mentioned back at the beginning of the show, coming up 1 week from tomorrow will be the annual Insect Fear Film Festival. Now, more than two decades has been going on here on the campus, and every time around, there is a particular insect that is the focus, and you show some movies and sometimes animated features, and there's an insect petting zoo, and it's fun for the whole family.
And two new features. As you say, we like to emphasize the cultural role that insects play. At 6 on the stage at Follander next Saturday, we'll have a demonstration of praying mantis-style kung fu. The predatory strike of the mantis has inspired an entire martial art form. In addition, we'll have Bug Scope, live, real-time, 10,000-fold magnifications of mantids. You can see their features up close and personal. At 7, we'll announce the winners of the art contest, introduce the films. We have two incredibly charming short films, digital animation called Mantis Parable, and then the paper animation film. Then 7:30, Deadly Mantis. Then Space Ghost Coast to Coast with giant alien Zorak, the giant alien mantis. And then we'll show Buffy the Vampire Slayer's Teacher's Pet episode about a substitute teacher who's actually a giant praying mantis who likes to devour young boys. So.
Mm-hmm.
Should be fun for the whole family.
Yeah, everything I know of being a talk show host, I learned from watching Space Ghost. And Zorak.
Well done.
Thank
well done.
Much. Thank you very much. Well, and that's at the Follinger Auditorium on the U of I campus.
Entirely free.
Entirely free. And that will be on Saturday the 18th, so 1 week from tomorrow. And there will be T-shirts and there will be lots of things. So it's a fun thing for families to do if you have kids. And then the way they always do this is that the later it goes in the evening, maybe the less family friendly the movies become. So if you want to take your kids, you can bring them in the beginning and they can hang out for some of that stuff. And then later on, you can decide whether it's appropriate for your children to see the films that are being offered. But it's a lot of fun, has been going on now for many years. And so you can go and check it out. You're looking for something to do on the 18th.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it. Mae Barenbaum, she is a head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She is a scientist who specializes in studying insects, and every once in a while she's here on the show, and we talk about them. I'm sure she'll be back here in the months ahead. In the meantime, she has authored a number of books about insects, and if you're interested, head down to the bookstore, go down to the library, just look for put her name there in the catalog, and I'm sure that she will come up with some stuff.